тише коло вранське, де бойки, а тише коло моїх.
Hey there, and welcome to Keep Calm and Choir On, a podcast about the power of singing together. My name is Ryan LaBoy, and I'm so excited to introduce our guest this week, Regina Stronsack. Regina is a versatile Twin Cities-based soprano who frequently performs as a soloist and ensemble singer, having sung with the inaugural class of the Seraphic Fire Professional Choral Institute at Aspen Music Festival, and locally with the Minnesota Chorale, Border Crossing, Impulse, and the First Readings Project. Graduating from the University of Minnesota with degrees in vocal performance and Spanish and Portuguese studies, her interest lies in communicating with diverse audiences through language and music. As an avid recitalist and champion of new music, Regina has a deep-seated passion for art song, having participated in the Barcelona Festival of Song and the Source Song Festival right here in Minneapolis. Regina is also a two-time Fulbright Scholar to Brazil, where she spent 2 years researching and performing Brazilian vocal chamber repertoire in the capital city of Brasilia. On a personal note, Gigi is a great friend of mine, and we must stop referring to her as Regina because she's really like my little sister. So Gigi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ryan.
It's great to have you on the show, and I'm just super excited to dig into some amazing questions from my students at North Hennepin Community College having to do with your life and your musical journey. And I'm also just so excited to listen to the music that you brought with you today because it's so interesting and unique, and I think our audience, our listening audience, is in for a real stretchy treat. I think they're going to have a good time.
Me too. I'm really excited for this.
So, Gigi, as you know, part of what we're going to discuss today are a series of interview questions from my students at North Hennepin Community College, and I think you can agree that there are just some really great questions coming from them having to do with your personal life and your musical study, as well as your time abroad. So why don't we just jump right in?
Let's do it.
From reading your extended biography, my students and I know that baby Gigi was really a STEM gal, wanted to be pre-med, was going to study science in college, and then somehow you found yourself at the Missouri Fine Arts Academy, which is a summer program in Missouri, and that changed the course of your life. So I'm wondering, can you tell us a little bit about MOFA and how that came to be and what makes it so special to you?
Yes, I was so into math and science. Calculus was my jam. I loved biology. I wanted to be a geneticist, but then felt a little discouraged when the human genome was already mapped out. So oh my God. I didn't know what else I was going to do.
I'll just say, our friendship blossomed at the right time.
Yeah, so I was always interested in science and puzzles and math. And I think now in hindsight, there's a lot of overlap with music in those areas. And I loved singing. I loved being a part of choir, being a part of a jazz choir in our high school. That was a smaller ensemble, and being involved with theater. And my theater teacher reached out to me and she said, hey, can I nominate you for this program? Because I think you would really benefit from it. And so I thought that was really cool. It was free. The government sponsored it.
What a nice acknowledgement from your teacher.
Yeah, it was. It felt really special to be considered for that. And so she helped me put together my audition recordings, and we sent it in. And then I got accepted as an acting student.
Oh, nice.
I went for acting. And I struggle putting it into words because it was students from all different artistic disciplines in visual arts, dance, theater, music, all coming together to learn about their own specific disciplines. But then we had a huge interdisciplinary focus that encouraged us to create something together over the course of 3 weeks in our own units. I didn't realize that being a professional artist was really something that was a possibility. And possibility is the word that I feel like I land on whenever I think about what I got the most out of MOFA, was seeing possibility between the different artistic disciplines.
So I have a question from you coming from a student of mine, Ben, who asks, can you talk more about the moment when you heard your calling after attending MOFA? What about it made you so brave to trust your gut feeling to go for music education, to study music education in college, and to stray off the path you had previously seen yourself on?
The moment with MOFA I think it was all culminating over a series of 3 weeks. And we're all singing together. We're all contributing our art forms in this final presentation. We're all seeing what each individual group has been working on over the past 3 weeks. And mm-hmm. they were like happenings of these creations that students had put together. And we walked into the stadium area, and it had been decorated with banners and with confetti. And there were people kind of coloring with chalk on the concrete walls, mm-hmm. and improvised music was being played on in the rafters. Like, it was this 360 experience, because you mm-hmm. were walking into it and seeing art on the ground, hearing music up above your head. And then even like tactile, there was like some water being tossed around in some ways. Like,
which, like... artists are so weird.
I loved it. It was great. Yeah,
of course. I would love it too.
And then and everything had its period of time that it was lasting. And so after like one thing was happening, another thing would transition into it. And there was a moment when everything just stopped. And I think the students were singing and like teaching us a song to sing along with them. And I just remember standing in the middle of that being like, this is magic.
Something we haven't really talked about yet is how Spanish and Portuguese studies found its way into your college experience. And so you ended up graduating actually with two degrees or two areas of major study. So I have a question from my student, Marie, who says, balancing two different majors sounds really challenging. Were there any aspects of one that helped you with the other?
Yeah, so luckily it ended up timing itself out that I wasn't starting two majors at the exact same time, because that would have been a lot. Music was heavily loaded in the first couple of years with their prerequisite courses, and then Spanish and Portuguese, the coursework that I took was able to be spread out over the last couple of years while finishing up the coursework in music as well. And I was able to study abroad for a semester too, which allowed me to get half of the coursework from my Spanish and Portuguese degree completed. It did take 5 years total to do the two degrees. And
nice
luckily
victory
I had
lap.
Victory lap, year five, still alive. That was my motto. So it took 5 years, and luckily I had a scholarship to assist me with that. Mm-hmm. But I did have a lot of coursework every semester, and it probably averaged around 18 credits a semester, which is
an incredible amount of work. Did you ever experience like academic fatigue or burnout?
I think I did overwork myself in a few of those semesters. Knowing what I know now, I probably would have paced out some things a little more or taken fewer courses and still been able to do what I needed to do for that.
I think this segues nicely into another area of conversation that my students are wanting to touch on, which is as a student, managing being a perfectionist. In your extended biography, you talk with me and my students about struggling with perfectionism. And so I have some questions for my students that I think I'd like to ask.
Yeah.
My first question then is going to come from my student, Jackie, who says, you dealt with perfectionism in high school and college. Do you still deal with it? And how has your relationship to perfectionism changed over time?
Perfectionism is something that I work through still. Mm-hmm. I used to see it as a positive thing when I was in high school, like some sort of little quirk or trait, meaning that I liked things being right and I liked doing them right and that I was hardworking enough that I would not stop until something was right. Mm-hmm. Now I look at that as just not an effective use of energy, both mentally and emotionally. And I think about this sometimes too with the career path that I'm on. If I would have stuck with biology or sciences or math, I might have used perfectionism to my advantage, which would not have been helpful or healthy for me at all. But in music, the negative aspects of perfectionism were much more apparent much earlier on. It would keep me from singing. It would keep me from progressing in my lessons, keep me from sort of reaching out for opportunities or introducing myself even. And I still struggle with perfectionism in some of the things that I do, but I can take a step back now and look at it and see how much time have I been spending on this, mm-hmm. and is spending more time on this going to make it exponentially better than it already is right now? Or is it fine the way it is?
Yeah. Is the juice worth the squeeze?
Yes. Yes.
And sometimes it is the case that it is. And sometimes it's just not. My student Avery says, I love the quote from your voice teacher, you'll never be, quote, perfect, but you're pretty damn good. What do you think helped you get over the fear of being a perfectionist as a musician? And what advice would you give someone who's struggling with the same?
Yeah, that quote sticks with me. My voice teacher, Dr. Mark Madsen, he saw me through some difficult times early on in learning how to sing. And there's freedom in knowing that I will never be perfect. So pretty damn good is still pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And I think about that when I'm practicing. I think about that when I'm writing, if I have to write for, like, especially for some of these grad school applications that I was putting together this year, I would stop and think, like, could I make this better? I could always make this better, but is this fine for right now?
We know from reading your biography that you are quite a world traveler and you have been to so many different places, and that specifically you studied extensively in Spain and then later in Brazil as a two-time Fulbright scholar. And so I would love to spend a little bit of time talking specifically about where your passion for culture came from, you know, growing up in the Midwest. How is it that you found yourself in the middle of Spain and then down in Brasilia in Brazil? And what are some of the joys and complications that come along with that? So the first question in this vein that I have for you comes from my student, Caitlin, who says, I understand that you love to learn language, but do you have any idea where your passion for those cultures specifically came from?
It originated in middle school. And I loved the fact that language was like a secret code that you could speak and maybe somebody else wouldn't know what it meant, but a specific group of people would know what it meant.
The right people.
The right people. and then when I learned that I could sing in those languages, that was a game changer.
Yeah.
So I would sing songs in French, some Mélodie, some Fauré, some Debussy. I would sing in German, and learning those languages became about the poetry. Portuguese came out of the blue my second year of college. There was a class offered called Portuguese for Speakers of Spanish that would have counted towards my Spanish minor. And I remember walking into the first class and I did not know how Portuguese was going to sound. I'd never heard it before in my life. I was so amazed by the sounds that were coming out of my teacher's mouth. And she was from Portugal, which is a completely different accent than you would hear normally in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And she introduced us to all these types of music that came from Portuguese-speaking countries and cultures. There were a couple of songs from Portugal and, like, one specifically from Brazil that really grabbed me.
So you've talked about your introduction to Spanish and to French and Portuguese and German. And so I have a question from my student Chuname, who asks, when you studied abroad, did you ever get scrutinized for having a wide range of languages without having blood ties to the culture? And I think that is an excellent question.
That is an excellent question. I don't know if I ever got scrutinized for speaking the languages. Sometimes I would get puzzled reactions from people as to, why are you here? A lot of the time in Brazil, I would get the comment from people in Ubers or some people that I would meet kind of just in passing. And they would say, so many people are leaving our country to go to your country. Mm-hmm. So why are you here?
And how do you answer them?
I mean, I talk about my love of music, my research, my passion for arts. And some people would find that interesting. And some people would also respond to that, you know, like, nobody here really knows about any of that stuff, though. So it was always a delicate dance, almost, of being somebody who is white, who is American, who my background is Polish and German. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any family ties to these cultures or to this history, and being sensitive to that and learning as much as I can about it.
We're getting a sense for the fact that you're quite well traveled and that you've been to a bunch of different places, but you had the honor, not once, but twice, of being a Fulbright scholar in Brazil. So congratulations to you, because that's a huge accomplishment.
Thank you.
For a young person to achieve once, let alone twice. I mean, I think that speaks volumes to your tenacity and your intellect and your passions that are developing in these really beautiful ways. My first question about your experience in Brazil actually comes from a student, Shai, who is asking about the Fulbright Commission. They say, Can you tell us more about the Fulbright Commission? How did you get involved with them? Did you apply or were you recommended? So what is Fulbright and how did you get involved, Gigi?
Fulbright is an organization that offers funding opportunities for research and for exchange, for educational exchange for students, not only in the United States, but in partnership with students in other countries around the world. Mm-hmm. I learned about Fulbright when I was probably a sophomore in college, my second year there. Mm-hmm. And I knew right off the bat that this was a goal that I wanted to work towards. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of different grant types that are available, and it depends too on the countries, but I knew Brazil was one of the options that I was very strongly considering. Mm-hmm. And so they have grants for research that are nine month long grants that have, they pay for your travel, they give you a stipend to conduct research, and you're affiliated with a university and you have a mentor at that university that you have reached out and contacted prior to applying. Mm-hmm. So that's a part of the application process. And the program that I was involved with was an English teaching assistantship. Mm-hmm. And I was paired with a university and I worked to provide supplementary coursework, supplementary activities in English for students in the English departments and students across the university who just wanted to improve their English. Mm-hmm. and look for ways to do that. So through the English teaching program, I was able to apply for a second year and worked as a leader in the Midwest of Brazil. So I was able to travel between a few different universities and do some site visits while also doing the regular work of an English teaching assistant at my own host university with my own host professors and students.
From being your friend, one thing I know about you is that your first year specifically living abroad in Brazil was really challenging. And
yes.
I actually was quite amazed and impressed that you applied for a second time, just given some of the circumstances that unfolded in your first year of study in Brazil. So I think this might be a good opportunity for us to talk a little bit about culture shock.
Yeah.
So first question, again, comes from my student Shai, who says, you mentioned culture shock during your experience in Brazil. What would you say was the most fundamental difference you noticed between American culture and Brazilian culture, and how did you adapt?
I think the thing that was most disorienting for me is that there were a lot of similarities. So in the city where I was living in particular, it was, the way it was constructed was very intentional. It was a modern city. It's in the shape of an airplane on purpose. Yeah. So it's very organized. And it felt almost like living out in the suburbs again, but without any access to like public transportation or not really knowing how to move about the city and move myself around. Mm-hmm. In an efficient way. I relied on Uber a lot. Mm-hmm. I walked maybe 2 miles to my university every morning because I couldn't figure out the way that the bus patterns were working, and nobody really seemed to understand how that worked either in the area where I was living. Another culture shock that was difficult to navigate for me was related to timeframes and safety. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who's very independent and likes doing my own thing, I had to adapt to a new sort of lifestyle that I can't go out by myself after dark, just given the way that the city was structured where I was at.
Right.
It was isolated, and we were briefed at the beginning of our grant just with things to be aware of related to violence and related to theft. And those were some real concerns that not only I had, but my students would have in their own communities.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you want to go into a country with the best of intentions. And when you enter a new country, you're so excited to absorb the culture and to taste the food and to hear the music and to walk down the streets that you don't want to rain on your own parade by concerning yourself with things like safety. And yeah, I can see where a debriefing on that subject would feel like a bit of a downer, but it is necessary. Not every city or every country is as safe as another.
Yeah. When you first arrive, it's a little disorienting to know like what is okay, what is doable.
I think I'd like to dive specifically into a piece of choral music that you found in Brazil that is fascinating and weird, and I really want to perform it myself now.
Yay!
Called Beba Coca-Cola. And if you're listening and you think you just heard the word Coca-Cola, you are correct, because this is a song that, in a sense, is about the soft drink. So, Gigi, let's talk a little bit about it.
Let's do it.
As the two-time Fulbright scholar, I'm going to lean heavy on you to introduce us to this piece of music. I know that you also have recently given presentations at the American Choral Directors Association about Brazilian choral music. So looking to you as the expert, can you tell us a little bit about the composer Gilberto Mendes?
Yeah, so Gilberto Mendes, he's from Santos, Brazil, a city on the coast in the state of São Paulo. And he's known for being a pioneer in aleatoric music, visual, concrete, and microtonal music. He works with mixed media. He's written new musical notation in his works. And he's associated with a group called Música Nova, which is a new music group in Brazil. And he had studied in Darmstadt, Germany, with Pierre Boulez, Henri Pousseur, and Stockhausen. His piece, Motet in D minor, Beba Coca-Cola, is one of his greatest known works. And he's very prolific in the amount of works that he's written. But this one really stands out among the repertoire. And yeah, it's based on a concrete poem, which, what does that mean? It is a poem that plays around with linguistic elements and typographical effect, mm-hmm. prioritizing that rather than the verbal significance of the words on the page.
Yeah, so the spacing of the words on the page or the shape that the poet creates with those words takes primary significance to necessarily the words themselves.
Yes. And so in Beba Coca-Cola, he takes this poem written by famous concrete poet Décio Pignatari, mm-hmm. where Beba, drink, Coca-Cola, all of those letters are rearranged and played with that create a very unique interpretation of those vowels and consonants, mm-hmm. and have a very significant message, even in the absurdity of how the words are arranged.
Yeah, and in reading one of the articles that you sent along by Andre Lopez Martins, I thought it was really interesting how he notes that Beba means to drink, and so the song is called Beba Coca-Cola, but that actually was a campaign slogan for Coca-Cola in the 1950s, was just simply drink Coca-Cola. And so there's a quote from his article I think I'd like to read that I found to be
particularly
interesting. So Martins says, Pignatari, who is the poet, Pignatari wrote Beba Coca-Cola in the mid-1950s. At a post-Second War moment, when he considered that the U.S. practiced a form of capitalist and expansionist imperialism that appeared increasingly prominent and radical. It was the birth of the Cold War, and in that context, perhaps one of the most striking symbols of American culture in the mid-20th century is the Coca-Cola soft drink. So I think that's a really interesting quote, because essentially what he's saying here is Pignatari, in being a little subversive, takes this like really wholesome American slogan, drink Coca-Cola, from the 1950s and creates this concrete poem based on it that sort of manipulates the syllables to make it mean something completely different. That is, like I said, a subversive commentary on capitalism and what did he say?
And consumerism.
So I'm wondering, Gigi, can you explain to us a little bit more about how Pignatari and then Mendes use the syllables Beba Coca-Cola to create this concrete poem and this choral work?
Looking at the poem and looking at the translation of the poem, even just slightly shifting the vowels from one place to another gives a significant difference in the meaning of the word. Mm-hmm. And so as this poem flows down, it starts with kind of that drink Coca-Cola slogan at the beginning. And as it goes down, it's drool, glue, drink cocaine, drool, glue, shard, shard, glue, cesspool. It ends on the word cloaca, mm-hmm. which is essentially the word used to kind of describe sewers or latrines, and also the anatomical term for the departure point in birds for where their feces and other bodily excrement comes out of.
Oh my God, it's the butthole.
It's the butthole, yes. It ends on the word butthole. And some of that progression and that dismantling of the text and repetitiveness of this anti-jingle, as it's often called, is kind of showing how you start with maybe some Coca-Cola, you consume it, and in the end, it's just all crap. Like, this consumerism is all crap.
That's so cool. Gigi, I'm wondering, actually, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but could you read this for us so that we get a sense of how specific these syllables are and how kind of strange it is that it all translates in this way?
Beba Coca-Cola. Babi Cola. Beba Coca. Babi Cola Kaku. Kaku. Cola. Cloaca.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, what is that? It's like five different syllables. Beba Coca-Cola. I mean, there's six syllables there, but the ko is repeated.
Yes.
So just using those five syllables, you get all of these different words that you just read for us that create this whole poem that you translated, which essentially goes from drink Coca-Cola to you just consumed crap.
Yeah. And that's, I'd reached out to a couple of conductor friends and friends from choirs, because unfortunately I have not sung this piece yet. And I really want to. Any conductors out there listening who want to program it, let me know. Yeah. And I'd reached out to them because they had performed it last year, the year after I left, and I was so jealous. So I reached out to them and said, like, what was your experience conducting this piece and singing it? And it, you have to really dive into the unique language of this piece. Mm-hmm. So like kind of understanding that message of everything being digested and coming out crap. That was the conductor that I'd worked with, Isabella Sakef. Mm-hmm. That was her, her insight of just, you know, you've got to make sure that all the singers are on board with it.
In a few of the recordings that I've watched of this, or in reading about the piece, there's like a theatrical component to it as well, where singers are supposed to hold up the letters of the word cesspool in Portuguese, the cloaca at the end. Or there's these extended vocal techniques that singers are playing with. So there's glissandos and there's exhalings and there's spoken parts and there's shouted phrases. And there's even like a culminating belch moment where that signifies the coda. And then the piece sort of comes to this raucous end. Yeah. I like how you called it an anti-jingle, or how others have called it an anti-jingle, because you definitely get that sense from how the piece is performed. So before we were talking about Beba Coca-Cola and the whirlwind sort of choral piece that it is, you mentioned, Gigi, that for you in your dealing with culture shock in Brazil, that singing really functioned as a saving grace for you, which leads to a wonderful set of questions for my students that have to do with singing and choir around the world, and how they're the same and how they're different. Our first question regarding singing in different communities around the world comes from my student Bin, who says, you seem to be really active in singing in different communities, even when you did your research in 2016 and performed with local groups in Brazil. Did singing in different cultures help you to gain new insight or perspectives?
Singing in different cultures and different contexts did give me some new perspectives and new insights. It's challenging to immerse yourself in a language that is not your native language. And then on top of that, learn technical terms mm-hmm. that you like can pick up instantly in your native language, but then realize that they're completely different in another context.
You mean like in terms of how we talk about music?
In terms of how we talk about music, yeah. So in one of the choirs that I sang with, we would meet at 8 a.m. A couple of hours, three times a week. And, you know, I would be as awake as I can be at 8 a.m. and then also just be as engaged as I could be in another language. But there were moments where I had to learn what the names for the note values were and interpret a verb that I maybe wasn't super familiar with. And, you know, they would ask for us to sing a certain way. And it would be a quick comment and then we would go into singing and I would just hope that the interpretation that I had in my brain was right and not the opposite.
Choral conductors are the worst for being like, I want you to sing this like it's warm. It's like putting peanut butter on warm toast. You're already having to interpret figurative language if it's your native language. And then on top of that, to be a non-native speaker.
Yeah. Or even, I still remember, I don't remember what the word was, but I remember being in that zone and knowing that the verb that they just asked us to sing to make the phrase was either to stretch it out or to make it short. It was either one of those two. Mm. And I like just kind of jumped in the moment to listen to what everyone else was doing and then asked for clarification afterwards. The rehearsal styles differ from conductor to conductor wherever you are in the world. But I think the rehearsal process in Brazil seemed a little more fluid. Mm-hmm. Versus some of the systematic ways that I've experienced singing here.
Yeah, so it wasn't necessarily as like structured or in a worst case scenario, rigid.
Yeah, and granted, I only sang with two specific choirs in the city where I was living.
Mm-hmm. And I know, Gigi, something that sort of drove you nuts about being in Brazil. You mentioned that rehearsals would start at 8 a.m. I'm guessing that based on what you've told me other times about your experience in Brazil, that it was maybe a soft 8 a.m.?
Yeah, time was very fluid as well. If I did end up walking in at 8:30, we might have not started yet, which is fine. Some of the conductors that I'd worked with would mention that was a frustration of theirs. When like we started a certain time and choir members wouldn't arrive until another period of time. And sometimes that had to do with work schedules. The city is very spread out, so it wouldn't be surprising if it just took somebody a while to get from their community to the rehearsal location. Just kind of had to roll with it.
Yeah, good thing you let go of your perfectionist self by then.
Oh, I had to. But it was really a great experience in singing and the types of repertoire that we would work on and sing together.
The next question I have for you comes from my student Brittany, who asks, what are the differences or commonalities you've noticed in choral music in Brazil and in the US? And how has your experience abroad influenced your views on choral and vocal communities?
Some of the similarities that I've noticed in choral music from Brazil and from the US are there's a good amount of sacred repertoire. Mm-hmm. Brazil's a country that's primarily Roman Catholic. There are a lot of mass settings that I've come across, music for religious purposes that are sung. There's actually a good deal of repertoire from the States that is performed commonly throughout Brazil. Some Lauridsen, I think we even sang some Jake Runestad.
Oh, nice.
When I was down there. But even the piece that we collaborated from a distance during the social distancing, and they invited me to be part of their virtual choir for Easter. So I sent in a recording. We sang a piece by Rudder. I'm blanking on which piece it was right now, but we sang it in English and they had subtitles in Portuguese for their listeners. Some differences, though, that I've noticed in repertoire from Brazil is that especially with songs that have a folk element to them or even arrangements of popular songs that are well-known throughout Brazil, is that there's an emphasis on rhythm and really feeling that rhythm. So oftentimes it'll be notated in a certain way. And we worked on this when we'll talk about the Goldie Hove piece. And when we were working with Ahmed last summer, a lot of the times you have to really just internalize the rhythm and feel it. You can't overanalyze it. And you have to really find that groove.
Yeah. It's like rhythm goes from being like a left brain metronomic aid to being a right brain dance, and you have to treat those differently. You You just referenced our next piece, actually, that we're going to dive into to listening in just a few minutes, which is by Osvaldo Golijov, the Pasión Según San Marcos, or the St. Mark's Passion. That is a major work that you and I had the privilege to perform together last year with the Minnesota Orchestra. And I'm so excited to talk about it today because it is like a mountaintop experience from my life. And having read your biography, we know that you feel similarly.
Yeah, this was, and I say this to whoever I have the chance to talk about this piece to when I nerd out about it, is that this is the highlight of anything that I've performed musically before. Mm-hmm. This is the combination of so many areas of interest for me, so many passions that I have. I hope we get to perform it again at some point.
So to tell you all a little bit about the piece, again, it's called La Pasión Según San Marcos, which translates to The Passion According to St. Mark. So this is a biblical retelling of the Passion of Christ. When we talk about a passion in music, we're talking about the final week of Jesus' life. So starting with Palm Sunday and ending in Easter Sunday with Jesus' resurrection and ascending into heaven, this is a narrative retelling according specifically to the Gospel of Mark in the Bible, if you're unfamiliar with that. It's a Spanish language piece, primarily a Spanish language piece, and lasts about 87 minutes. And there are 34 individual movements, although movements 11 and 12 are kind of tied together. So you could say 33. The big takeaway is there are many movements and many different pieces within this piece of music. And it is as much a piece of theater as it is a piece of musical art. It was premiered in the year 2000, actually was commissioned in the year 2000, or maybe it was commissioned in 96 or 98, but premiered in 2000 in Stuttgart, Germany. It was commissioned by the International Bach Academy, which is headed by Helmut Rilling, as part of their Passion 2000 project, which was a project taken on to commemorate the 250th anniversary of Johann Sebastian Bach's death. Something unique about the piece, it historically has been performed almost exclusively by the Escola Cantorum de Venezuela, conducted by Maria Guinand. Maria is a force of a conductor, and she actually came to Minnesota to work with us on this piece last summer, and it was just, this woman is a legend in the world of conducting and choral music, so to have the opportunity to work with her firsthand,
it was so cool. She's a force.
At the time of its premiere in 2000, Helmut Rilling, who, if you don't know who that is also a legend in conductor land, had his doubts about how successful this piece would be because it was so unconventional. However, to his pleasant surprise, at its premiere, this piece received a solid 25-minute standing ovation. 25 minutes.
That's I believe it.
When we performed it with Minnesota Orchestra, even, it was incredibly well received, and people bought tickets to come back the next night.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it is a wild piece that combines so many different types of music. I think part of what is so fabulous about it is there's so much Afro-Latin influence in this classical context, right? So Golijov takes some Afro-Cuban rhythms, some bossa nova, some tango, some rumba, some flamenco, and weaves it all together to be this very, like, literally passionate retelling of the Passion of Christ. When he was writing the piece, Golijov really struggled with whether or not, first of all, he was going to do it at all, because he is of Jewish descent. He is a non-Christian person who was tasked with telling this incredibly intimate Christian story. And so he felt the pressure of that and didn't know that he was the right person to be doing it. But then he actually came across a painting of Rembrandt's and was inspired. So I'd like to read this quote from Golijov directly. He says, "Like Rembrandt recorded the Jews, I want to record the Christians, simply that. For instance, my great-grandmother had a picture of Jeremiah lamenting the fall of Jerusalem by Rembrandt. It's the greatest Jewish picture ever, and he was not a Jew, but he lived amongst them," he meaning Rembrandt. "I cannot aspire to be Rembrandt, but if at least one section of the Passion has the truth about Christianity that Rembrandt's paintings have about Judaism, I'll be all right. That's enough." So I think it's really fascinating that Golijov is an outsider to the Christian faith, and yet is tasked with presenting this very extensive Greek chorus onlooking this, like, Christian carnage.
Yeah, I think it's, when you look at the paintings that inspired him too, there's a lot of a lot of parallels that he draws with the Holocaust and with the martyrdom of Christ.
And also he, like, I know that in reading about him, he tapped into, more so perhaps than his Jewish roots, his Latin American roots as an access point to empathizing with the story of Christ's passion.
Yeah, the parallels between the history of not only Africa and Latin America, but how the parallels with sacrifice and martyrdom were compared with colonization from Spain and the atrocities of that.
Yeah, and something that's really interesting about the piece too is how he assigns the voice of Jesus in that same vein. And Jesus is sung by three different characters in this piece, three different soloists. The first time that we hear from Jesus, it's as a soprano. So a female soprano singing the role of Jesus in this, the quote unquote early style, right? This like typical classical style that we associate with soprano singing. The second time that we hear from Jesus, he is portrayed as a mezzo soprano in the style of Mercedes Sosa, who is one of Latin America's like big prominent folk singers, and has this very sort of earthy quality to her singing. And then the third time we hear from Jesus, he's portrayed by a baritone. So a third time as a male singer in this Middle Eastern style of singing. But Goldenhoff said about this very topic that the reason he assigned the voice of Jesus to the female voice is because it is the women of Latin America who understand suffering the best. They suffer the most, they understand it the best. And so it makes sense that Jesus would be characterized by the female voice.
Especially having come back from Brazil 6 months earlier, when we had started the rehearsal process, I was still kind of processing my experience and readjusting to life in the States again. And I was really drawn to the parallels that they were doing with the history of the countries. And there were a lot of similarities I saw from my time in Brazil with some of the sentiments that Goldenhoff was kind of portraying through the piece. La Passion is about the miracle of faith in Latin America. And even when all of this, these atrocities are happening and all of this stuff is going on, there's still this faith. When I talked with some of the Venezuelan singers after we had performed La Pasión, some of these singers who have performed it many, many times, and we having just performed it for the first time, we were talking about how it was such a beautiful piece, but it was a really painful, beautiful piece. If you look at all of the rhythms, you look at the instruments involved, you hear the harmonies and the tonalities, there's African influence, you've got indigenous elements, you've got the elements that come from Europe, and the way that they're all woven together made this really beautiful sound and this really stunning piece of art. But all of these things came together as a result of some really painful and tragic acts in history.
And yet, like you said, amid all of this, people in Latin America cling so closely to their faith. And the hope that their faith brings for better tomorrows. And I think that also is reflected beautifully in La Pasión Según San Marcos, in movements like Demo Gracias,
yes,
that we'll listen to a little bit. It's sort of like the most hymn-like of pieces in the piece, but has this like fabulous and urgent rhythmic underpinning. Can be extracted actually as a solo octavo if you wanted to perform just that piece as a choir, or the Kaddish at the end of the piece. You know, piece itself uses primarily the text of St. Mark to tell the story, but Goldenhoff, being a Jewish composer, inserts the Kaddish, or the prayer for the dead, at the end of the Passion to close it out. And again, you have this very beautiful, reverent quality of music.
Another comment that I'd like to make too, just as I'm thinking about it, going back to that conversation with some of the Venezuelan singers after the performance, we could only really describe it as like a big, beautiful mess of stories, of history. And I even think about the influence that the United States is tangled into that story. The U.S. played a role in a lot of the overturning of governments during that period of time. Yeah. And that's something that I'm trying to educate myself more on and learn more about. Mm-hmm. But to know that we're all a part of it.
We're all woven together.
Yeah.
You tell a collective human story.
I remember writing in my graduate school essays as I was processing this piece and talking about some of the stuff I was interested in, is that like history is complicated and painful and we're all tangled in it together. But music while it won't be able to cure injustice, it can serve as part of the healing process.
Mm.
And I really feel that La Passion was a very healing piece to sing.
It's impossible for us to find the words to describe just the monumental nature of this piece. And unfortunately, within this podcast, we don't have an unlimited amount of time to listen to it or talk about it. But I would like to weave together just a few different sound bites from different movements that you can listen to. So our first sound bite is going to come from one of the opening choral scenes, the primer annuncio, or the first announcement, where we are tasked as singers to sing with this very bright, forward, indigenous sound. And sort of call, it's the calling of the story together. The next selection you're going to hear is Por qué, which is asking the question, why are we doing this? And it features a soloist in the style of Celia Cruz, the famous Cuban singer. The soloist in this performance is going to be Joconda Cabrera. The next snippet that we'll listen to is, we talked a little bit about Demos Gracias, which is this prayer of giving thanks to God with this hymn-like setting that has a sense of urgency coming from the rhythmic underpinning. Next, we'll listen to Gigi's favorite movement, which is the Amanecer, which is this snarling, weird, deep-rooted, anguishing moment that Pilate is summoning Jesus to his death. And then we'll hear a bit from this Carnival party as Jesus is brought to Golgotha. And then finally, you'll get to hear a little bit of the Jewish prayer for the dead, the Kaddish, that ends the piece altogether.
Despiértense.
Thank you.
So just to reflect a little bit, Gigi, about what we've talked about today, you've shared so much about your experience both as a singer domestically and abroad, and you've talked so beautifully about how that has influenced your perspective as a singer. And I'm going to conclude by asking you the same question that we ask of all of our guests, which is, based on our conversation and the pieces of music that you brought with you today, what is the power of singing together?
It is so much. It is something that I miss a lot in these days, and something that I know that my heart wants to participate in as soon as possible. There's nothing like community, and the way that singing together brings people together makes individual voices a part of something. And I'm not just talking about the local community, the local context, but even globally exchanging and globally singing together. I have so many fond memories of singing with our friends from Venezuela, singing with my friends in Brazil, singing with friends and colleagues in Spain when I was there. And it's a way to bridge some divides, not necessarily divides that are put up for any one reason or another aside from distance. But when you can bring people closer, there's more room for understanding and appreciation.
Well, thank you so much, Gigi, for talking with us today and making some time and being so generous with your time to talk with us, and for also serving as a bridge for those of us who don't have the privilege of having studied in Brazil or in Spain or in really any Latin American context. For those of us who don't know much about it, you've served beautifully as an ambassador for those cultures and their music today. So on behalf of me and my students, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated all of those thoughtful questions. They were so beautifully crafted and helped me reflect a lot on just my experience so far.
Well, best of luck to you in these times, Gigi, and I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, hope to see you soon.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Keep Calm and Choir On, and thank you again to our guest, Regina Stronsek. I'd like to additionally thank Christina Rodel-Sorum, host of the podcast Art More Lovely, for her help with co-producing this episode, and offer a huge thank you to my choir students at North Hennepin Community College for their thoughtful questions. If you enjoyed today's music and conversation, be sure to like and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/choironpodcast, and stay caught up on our latest episodes by subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. And as always, you and your friends can find us on our website, choiron.buzzsprout.com.